Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Truth and Movies today. Justice League. DC give their heroes the weed on treatment, not in the Donald Trump sense, but is it just as awful as the last one? Good time, they're not having one. You will, in Robert Pattinson's blistering story of small-time crookery. Plus, Mudbound, a hit from Mississippi. Daddy's Home 2, Fireworks, and more. Not forgetting Film Club, Dog Day Afternoon. Sidney Lumet's sweltering 1975 story of a man doing a bank hit to make a miss. It's all in Truth and Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. We are Truth and Movies. Specifically in this case, it's...
David Jenkins.
Hi. Head honcho of the Little White Lies media empire.
I wouldn't say honcho.
Would you not?
No, just sort of prank monkey.
Big cheese.
Yeah.
And in from Film 4, hello, Michael Leader.
Hello, James.
All right.
I'm glad to be back. I think I'm the Truth and Movies unofficial bloated sci-fi movie correspondent at this point, aren't I?
Oh, well, it's so good that you're in today.
Yeah.
Yeah. You've been quite busy this week. What else have you seen this week?
I saw Fireworks for Little White Lies, which is an anime film that had a one-night-only screening on Wednesday, but might have a few other pickup screenings later in the week.
Right, okay.
But I wouldn't say it's worth seeing.
Oh.
My review's on the site.
Okay. Mm-hmm. On the Little White Lies website. And David, you've also been to the cinema.
Oh, yeah. I mean, do you want me to talk about that film?
Well, you don't have to.
I went in on a Sunday morning to see a work entitled Daddy's Home 2, which was horrid. Mel Gibson and Will Ferrell, and they're just larking about.
Yeah.
Is it Christmas as well? I just can't muster the sort of words to really kind of go into it.
Don't worry.
It is what it is. There wasn't much mirth.
No.
There wasn't much Christmas mirth there,
okay,
shall we say.
Daddy's Home 1 probably was.
Do you know what? Maybe that I didn't like Daddy's Home 2 because I didn't see Daddy's Home 1.
Ah.
So the kind of complexities of that situation were lost on me.
One day when we have lots of time, we should have a conversation, perhaps, if you like, about Will Ferrell and whether there's a greater waste of talent, a more naturally funny guy. I think you'd be hard-pressed to find, and yet he consistently chooses truly awful projects.
I mean, it's interesting to sort of do the Ferrell-Carell comparison,
right?
Because, you know, where Carell does the silly stuff, he mixes it with the serious stuff and does the serious stuff actually quite well. He's really good in the new Richard Linklater film, Last Flag Flying.
Mm. But also in Battle of the Sexes, which we'll be reviewing next week.
But then, Ferrell doesn't really do the serious stuff to sort of, you know, justify that there's more to him than kind of like man-child wobbling.
Mm. Nice, though, that is. Lots of people have been writing in. You can get in touch, as you know, our email, truthandmovies@tcolondon.com. Twitter is @LWLies. There's Facebook. There's also the Little White Lies homepage, which, if you're very clever, you can find your way to a little back room with comments on. A couple of people who made it there this week. Andrew Nagel. Just wanted to drop in and say, I love the podcast. Thank you, Andrew. I would like to recommend Best Picture Academy nominated film Babe for Film Club. That's a left field choice.
George Miller. Mr. Mad Max.
Of course.
It's very good. And I would actually say I prefer Babe 2, Pig in the City.
Really?
Which is an incredible film. I mean, it's like Mad Max with pigs.
You're known for your left-field choices, but David, with that one, you've gone out of the ballpark, taken a bus,
seriously, when you see it, I especially think, as a fan of the film Paddington 2,
yes,
I think there is a direct correlation between those two films. Babe 2, Pig in the City is very, very similar to the Paddington films.
Okay, well, let's schedule that in.
Okay.
Excellent. Cy Sal just touches in on the whole parenting controversy in the Florida Project, but says they really enjoyed the conversation there and the movie, of course. Some comments on Twitter. David Roll saluting the triumph of the death of Stalin and the way it pulled off the trick of acknowledging the evil while showing the buffoonery embedded in any human endeavour. Not any, David, not any. But yes, I completely agree with you. And James says, I had an interesting experience last week. I managed to finally catch Baby Driver. I forgot Kevin Spacey was in the movie. He's clearly a tremendous actor, but I didn't know how to watch the film in the same way, considering the amount of allegations against him. It makes you think very differently of people. I know a lot has been written about this, but what are your thoughts on separating the art from the real world? Boy, that's a big question, this from James. Can we still watch films? Effectively, do we have to jettison half the last 20 years of Hollywood output, or probably all Hollywood output ever? Can we still appreciate people's art despite the fact that they've done bad things, which in no way is meant to lessen the import of the things that they've done? But surely their art, what people create as an artist, is beyond what character issues they have, what flaws they have as a person.
Michael, do you want to give a definitive answer to this debate once and for all?
I will close the
book. Can you still listen to Michael
one.
Jackson?
I still do.
Yeah.
It's a very big question, and almost an academic one, at a time where academic questions almost put us further away from actual changes.
Okay.
I think that James really hits on a feeling that it's going to become more common with when these allegations come out and when these conversations occur. But it's more important that we see these people who they are and make changes and say the change that Ridley Scott has already enacted to recast that role in his
right.
film and replace Kevin Spacey. It's to make sure that this bad behaviour is reckoned with.
Another example, Brett Ratner, who's now been removed from the Wonder Woman 2 production.
Gal Gadot really using her sort of mettle now to be able to make change there. Mm. Is to make sure that in the hiring practices going forward we can change and then look back and see how we feel about films that have already been made. But then works of art throughout history, we don't necessarily claw through the biographies of the artists as well.
I did see that, yes, a lot of people were saying with this, the thing regarding Ridley Scott's All the Money in the World and the recasting of Kevin Spacey with Christopher Plummer, that you know, so they better make sure that someone's done a deep background check on Christopher Plummer, because you know, like, is anyone morally pure? You know, well, I mean, it's a philosophical thinker, I think.
It is, and thanks for raising it, Chase, because it is an important question. I do hope that we're able to consider that while we're also putting full weight behind the need for changes, which you touch on there. Michael. Interesting. I tell you what, speaking of things that need to be excised, crimes against humanity that need to be removed from the big screen, that brings us on nicely to Justice League and Superman's mustache, which we'll be coming to after this. It's not easy being DC department. Justice League hits the screens this week, featuring all sorts of stars as Batman rounds up a group of superheroes to save the world from an otherworldly threat. If only Superman wasn't so very dead, eh? Here is the moment, anyway, when Bruce Wayne encounters the Flash.
I know you have abilities. I just don't know what they are.
My special skills include Viola, web design, fluent in sign language, Gorilla sign language.
Silica-based quartz sand fabric. Abrasion resistant. Heat resistant.
Yeah, I do competitive ice dancing.
It's what they use on the space shuttle to prevent it from burning up on re-entry.
I do very competitive ice dancing. Whoever you're looking for, it's not me.
I don't think he needed to slam that fridge door quite so loudly, did he? That's actually, of course, a batarang, is that right?
He's testing the Flash's reflexes.
Right.
By chucking one of his signature weapons.
It's a batarang, Michael, isn't
it? Batarang. It doesn't come back, though.
It's unfortunate that he kills him and Flash is then out of the film and the franchise for good.
Whoops.
Whoopsie.
Whoopsie. All right, let's start with the good news. It's DC's shortest film yet.
Hurrah! That was that was keeping hope alive for me.
Right.
And do you know what? Actually, when you Google it, this was actually terrifying. When you Google Justice League, the sort of Google page that comes up still says that it's 2 hours 50 minutes.
Ooh.
So
is that what it originally was?
I don't know if it was cut down or what, but yeah, it's not 250 minutes, which is massive cause for celebration.
A mandate from the CEO of Warner Brothers to get it under 2 hours.
Okay.
So I think we can tell that there's been a lot left out of this film.
Right. Not enough, some would say. Originally, this was a Zack Snyder production. A horrible family tragedy forced him to leave the project and allowed DC to bring in Joss Whedon, who, of course, pretty much put up Marvel's tentpole with the original Avengers and the sequel as well. I don't know how Marvel feel about him jobbing for the competition, but this also involved extensive reshoots, which led to its own problem. Michael, you were writing on Twitter, 2 decades on from Terminator 2, Jurassic Park and Toy Story, we finally found the limits of CGI magic, convincingly erasing an actor's moustache.
Yes, during the reshoots, Henry Cavill, who plays Superman, I don't think it's a spoiler to say that he's back in this film. He's not been in the promotional copy, but he's been on the campaign trail. During the reshoots, he'd grown a moustache for the Mission Impossible movie that he's currently shooting and contractually couldn't remove it, so they thought, oh, we'll remove it in post. And it's actually given us quite an easy visual motif of finding which scenes were reshot, because it looks like he's just had a hefty injection of Botox.
It looks like he's had his mouth superimposed onto a face, you know, like someone else is doing the dialogue and it's just like...
It's truly bizarre.
It really is like so odd. I was trying to think while I was watching it, I was thinking, oh, Superman, maybe being in a casket for so long, you've got some rigor mortis in your top lip.
Your hair grows on after you die, so they say, you know, after the body ceases to function, hair just persists.
No, but Superman,
like those Japanese soldiers after the Second World War.
Superman couldn't have a moustache because his whole thing is like... His disguise is one set of glasses.
Oh, yeah.
So, like, people would be like, who's that guy that looks like Superman with a moustache?
Right. Regarding Joss Whedon, you were talking about the time being one of your kind of rays of hope about this. For mine, it was Joss Whedon, the fact that I thought he'd bring a little bit of...
levity.
Sass and wit and knowingness, which I found almost entirely absent from the film. The script's a bit of a boob, no?
Yes. DC films have been very different to Marvel films over the years. Much more serious, much more stately, much more grand, or at least ambitions towards being grand. But since Suicide Squad last year, it seems that they've had a bit of a rethink in terms of the tone of their films and wanting to make them lighter. And it feels like this has been aggressively rewritten and then reshot to inject humour. Mm. And it's just cut and paste Joss Whedon one-liners, mainly from the same characters. That's pretty much what The Flash is there for. You heard that in the clip, that he's just kind of...
He's the kind of Spider-Man role, would you say?
He's the comic relief, yeah.
Yeah, he's a sort of nervy, anxious kid, self-identifies as the most Jewish superhero ever. And he's there to make a sort of snarky comment or a self-effacing comment or just a rug pull, which is what Joss Whedon brought to the Marvel Universe, but at least wove it more into an actual satisfying screenplay.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Were your expectations met? Were you disappointed?
I always like to give these films, you know, a kind of fair kind of go. I think that Zack Snyder is a visionary filmmaker, but sometimes quite a bloated and overblown filmmaker. But he does compose some good shots in Batman vs Superman and Man of Steel, and his tone is his own. It's quite astounding to see those films in contrast to the Marvel movies. This one seems like a complete mess, and one... not entirely by design because of the sad production story, but also you can tell that it's being pulled in 3 different directions. Warner Brothers wants it to be more funny. Zack Snyder doesn't finish the film he wants to finish. Joss Whedon's brought in and does whatever he wants. It's an interesting sort of counterpoint to Thor Ragnarok from a couple of weeks ago, where you could tell that there was a filmmaker who was on set, Taika Waititi, infusing his voice into every line read, every kind of bit of business on set with real people.
Right.
And Joss Whedon, coming in as he is in post-production, infuses Joss Whedon into everything almost other than the actual DNA of the story and the performances. It's all in the edits and the post-production and some really bad rewriting. Some of his worst writing, I'd say.
It's not all bad, but it's the amount of money and people's effort and time that's gone into it. It's just remarkable that they couldn't produce anything better than this. Sadly, one of the best bits, I thought, was the post-credits scene, which involves a speed-off between Flash and Superman.
Yeah, I mean, usually for those post-credits scenes, it's generally a kind of tee-up for further business. I mean, you know, you get a kind of little cliffhanger, but for this one, they've gone for, you know, it's more of a, you know, don't want to spoil it, but it's more sort of jokey. And it's, you know, I think by far the best bit in the film. I mean, there's actually a bit of chemistry between two of the players, and which is kind of notably absent in the kind of preceding 2 hours. It is one of those films that I think it's like a kind of, it feels like a kind of F10 film. It's
what
like,
does Function 10 do?
It's just, you know, it just feels like someone's pressed a button and a film's come out.
Oh,
you know,
I
it's
see,
like a shortcut to film, you know? You're watching it and there's no kind of real evidence that anyone's made an effort to sort of think, what could we do new here? How could we switch up the template? How could we make these characters do something different, feel different? How can we sort of give them different dilemmas to face and emotions to feel? And I do talk a lot about how Marvel movies are the same, and you know, this one almost sort of takes it to almost a kind of parody level, I think.
I disagree with you. I don't think they're the same. But I do think that this is, as you say, very much just kind of churned out of the other end of the machine after a very great deal of offal's been put in at the point of origin. I quite like the way it started, actually, when it was still more in a comic book mode, a kind of classic rooftop scene between Batman and a hoodlum. But then it just descends into something else. And I feel there's probably a limit to how many times the Earth can get invaded by kind of otherworldly beings.
In this case, it's kind of a very kind of bland Skeletor type who cackles and who talks about destroying the world, voiced by Kieran Hines. It's really like, as baddies go, he is a bit of a kind of charisma vortex, really.
He's named Steppenwolf. Is there any kind of classical basis for that? I mean, it makes me think
band?
Of the
I don't know.
No, the book, I would well,
Well, the character was created by Jack Kirby, who was you know, one of the great kind of comic artists and creators of all time. Mm. And during his phase where he worked at DC after leaving Marvel, and he created a whole comic book universe called the New Gods.
Right.
And it seems that's what they're pillaging here. But yeah, Steppenwolf, I think, he probably just thought it was a cool name.
Right,
but
well, it certainly is.
It's interesting, again, to compare with Thor Ragnarok, which is another very Kirby-influenced film. You can almost see with Hela, the antagonist in that film, her headgear is very similar to Steppenwolf's headgear here. But that's the only comparison you can make between the two, because this is such a murky-looking film. And to take some of the most eye-popping art from comics and turn it into such grey sludge, really sad to see.
What do you feel about this, that I've read about these sort of Zack Snyder films, which I think are sort of all awful, including this one, and a lot of people kind of level the blame at Christopher Nolan. He was the kind of first person to do the kind of the serious Batman movies, bringing that kind of the existential weight of being a superhero and sort of channeling it into those stories,
which is maybe something, a momentum for which had been building already through kind of graphic novels and from Frank Miller onwards, and also Alan Moore, of course. I mean, his incredible Watchmen series and that. So yeah, that's one of the problems, I think you're right, of this film, the fact that it thinks it's worthwhile taking itself seriously.
It really sort of shows up how great those Nolan films were, that he was able to infuse a sense of gravitas into the proceedings. And they are long films, but I think what this film lacks, and it's maybe due to the fact that it has been sort of chopped up and fiddled about with, but there are all these dramatic scenes, but there's no drama. There's no kind of like pause. I mean, it's the kind of, you feel like it's the moments where people are waiting for something to happen, or the moments where people are kind of thinking about something that's just happened. That's like, that's where the drama is.
Yeah. All right. So, David, a score?
I would say my expectations were very muted because I hate Zack Snyder. So I'm going to say anticipation 1.
Right.
And I also thought the poster was terrible. It's got the tagline, "You can't save the world alone." Unless you're, you know, Superman or Batman
probably
or
Cyborg
Wonder Woman.
Could as well, I feel.
Yeah, I think a lot of them probably could, yeah. Although I've been very, very overwhelmingly negative about it, relatively speaking, I'd probably give this a 2, because
a 2.
Although it was very boring and it was very much a kind of cut-and-shunt job.
So glad you said that the right way around.
The sort of anger I felt after Batman versus Superman was so intense that, you know,
you didn't get that on this. And I noticed, I was checking my watch to see when the first time you checked your watch was, and it was, I think, about an hour in, unless you were doing it very surreptitiously.
Yeah, I think about
so
I had
to carry you along for a bit. Michael, some numbers. You can use minuses if you want.
As I said, I probably would be 3 for anticipation, just because I want to go in and enjoy these films. I don't go in and expect the worst. But yeah, I'd say enjoyment 2, and in respect 1, this really doesn't deserve to be talked about again.
Okay, I'll sign off on that as well. Hey, next up, let's talk about the very excellent Good Time. That's right, the Safdie brothers, Benny and Josh, who I was not previously familiar with, but one of whom takes a key role in this production, which features Robert Pattinson playing a petty crook who scrambles to post bail for his mentally disabled brother, played by Benny Safdie, following a comically sloppy bank job. Terrific film, which received a 6-minute long standing ovation after its screening at the Cannes Film Festival. Why are either of you there?
They're there. So, I mean, like, if you don't give them an ovation, it's kind of like, like, if you look, you know, terrible, terrible films have got 10-minute long-standing ovations.
I did not know that.
I will say that there's probably some sincerity behind the ovations.
What makes this film so terrific then, David?
I mean, it is really just relentless. I mean, it's. I think that's probably the only word to describe it. You got Robert Pattinson doing a kind of... A lot of people have tried to describe his performance here, and I think it's one of the reasons why we picked up on Dog Day Afternoon, because he really is channeling that kind of 70s De Niro, Pacino, full immersion kind of technique. He just feels like a completely different person. He's just let the character infuse his entire being, and he's doing all the facial expressions, keeping this really great, like, very, very credible accent. Mm. I mean, you know, just to go on a little sort of segue for a second, I mean, I think Robert Pattinson is... He's done good, basically. He's in a film that I wasn't that hot on called Lost City of Zed, where he played opposite Charlie Hunnam. He is just astonishing in the film as a supporting character, to the point where I was like, I wish the film was about him.
That's such a bad film, isn't it?
I found that film very boring. But yeah, in this one, as you say, he plays this crook who is kind of, he's on this kind of like, road to hell, I think, and the title is ironic. He's a guy prone to making just awful decisions, sometimes for the right reasons, sometimes for the wrong reasons. It's all about this idea of, is what he's doing morally right, because he's trying to save his brother and he's trying to be a family man and he's trying to make things good for the family, or is he an awful person because the sort of manner in which he is trying to achieve this dream gets more and more and more, like, debased.
Mm. It is absolutely, as you say, relentless from the start to the finish. The music, it's just kind of one long climax.
I love the music. It's Daniel Lepatin, who is an electronic musician who performs his Warner Tricks, Point Never. And it's just this squalling synth, kind of reminiscent of Tangerine Dream's 80s scores or a bit of John Carpenter in there. But it's a really hip soundtrack and one that really ratchets up the movie beyond its budget. It really comes across like it's all climax all the time, as you say. But the opening of the film is incredible. Yeah. It condenses probably a whole heist movie into maybe 15 minutes. Mm. And then it's just this one wild night afterwards while Connie is kind of, I think, just a creature of short-term thinking. He has no big picture. He's just, who's the next person I need to hustle to get to point B, to point C, to point D, point E? And Pattinson gives such a perfect performance as that.
Right. So many great sequences in there. I won't go into them too much because, you know, hopefully people are going to go and see this. I didn't know, as I say, anything really about the Safdie brothers. Their next project apparently features Jonah Hill in the lead role. Uncut Gems is called.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
One of their big things is street casting. So they get a lot of people, real people, into the film, and most of the cast, apart from Benny Safdie and Pattinson, are non-professionals. One of the main characters in it is a friend of theirs who was in prison, and he was in their previous film called Heaven Knows What, which is also amazing, which is about heroin addicts in New York. The lead actress in that was someone they discovered on the street. She was a heroin addict herself, and she is just astonishing in it.
Heaven Knows What came out in 2014. Apparently, Pattinson saw that and then got in touch with them and said, I really want to work with you. And they then wrote the part of Connie, the main protagonist, for him.
Wow. But that's what's so interesting about this film is that it's taking that sort of social street cast drama from their previous work and infusing it with this Martin Scorsese After Hours Mean Streets type vibe, where it's more of a genre film. But it's always there, the sort of the social realist aspects, the drama, the real sort of grit, you know, alongside what is a chase movie.
Mm. I think one of the other interesting things about this film, which I think is so great, is this idea of the depiction of New York as well. Mm. You might kind of call it unflattering. It's not like Woody Allen's Manhattan. It's set in and around Queens. Mm. They're not trying to tell like a New York story where they're trying to encapsulate the kind of iconic places and people and scenes from a city. They really try and encapsulate the sort of atmosphere and, you know, what it's like to walk down a street at night, what it's like to enter into an apartment block, what it's like to like break into a hospital. It is kind of revolting, but at the same time there is something quite magical about it, and you know, it's hard to describe why, but yeah, you know, it's a very unrelentingly bleak film, but that bleakness is
I don't know about unrelentingly bleak. There's a lot of comedy in this as well. No,
I mean, it's very sort of dark humour.
Oh, it's hugely dark, yeah.
One of the other things that people have written about the film, which is, again, quite an interesting point, is that it's a film about white privilege. Yeah. this is about a kind of young white guy exploiting...
Nearly all of his marks, all of the people he hustles, are kind of low-income, you know, people of colour. Yeah.
Right.
And he's just there as this bull in a china shop, just coming into their lives and taking what he needs to get to the next stage.
Wow, that's
interesting. And, you know, it's most... We won't say what happens, but it's kind of most pointed with the character of Barkhad Abdi that he plays, mm-hmm. who was in Captain Phillips.
Right.
And he plays a night watchman security guard who has, you know, made a life for himself here in Queens and is slogging away, and Connie comes and... Has his way, you know.
Has his way.
Yeah.
All right. What numbers would you give this, Michael?
You know, back in Cannes when we saw it, I didn't have much in the way of anticipation for it. Really? So a three, I was, you know, prepared to enjoy it. A four and a four, I'd say. Really strong.
My anticipation was higher, I think, because I'd loved Heaven Knows What. So probably fours across the board, I would
really?
Say. I loved it, but I didn't quite think it was up. Like, Heaven Knows What, I think, is a five-star film for me.
Okay.
But this isn't. There was just a few notes here that didn't quite hit. But
I've not seen Heaven Knows What, so... For me, my needle was definitely poking in the red of five this one. Yeah, I absolutely loved it. I mean, I think you said a sensory overload and just a lot of it almost seemed like a dream sequence, but a very bad dream. Anyway, that's good time. Got another film for you before we get on to Film Club, and it's Mudbound. We'll have a quick chat about that after this. There Will Be Mud on a Mississippi farm. Two families, one black, one white. In the quagmire of the Deep South, each family having a veteran returning home from World War II to find that the battles aren't over. It's an epic, somewhat sprawling tale, would you say?
Well, certainly, yeah. It has this feeling of an epic because, as you say, these two families, but the sort of narrative perspective shifts between probably five or six characters. It's very novelistic in that sense. So even though it's quite a personal story, it does have this epic sweep. But also, as you say, taking in historical events after World War II and this sort of pre-civil rights movement south. It's a really fascinating movie. We're watching it alongside Justice League. It's a film that is, you know, completely very powerful and very wise. You know, the way that it looks at people and the crossing of generations and the tensions between them.
What can you tell me about the director, Dee Reese?
I don't really know that much about her. I know that she made a film called Pariah. And actually, she did a biopic for TV as well on
Bessie
Smith.
Which had, I think, Queen Latifah as Bessie Smith. She's got Mary J. Blige in this one, which was a real shock to me when I read afterwards.
She's astonishing and kind of unrecognisable. She plays this kind of ex-slave family matriarch who, instead of having this kind of real sense of they're out of this kind of horrific time in American history, they've sort of come out the other side of it. It's a time of high anxiety and kind of keeping your head down and not wanting to sort of go there again. And the film is very much about kind of the tentative reintegration of kind of black and white people in that kind of post-bellum era.
Yeah.
It's interesting what you say about Justice League, whereas, I mean, this film, I think, for me, it has the real, genuine... epic sweep of like a David Lean film or something. You know, it feels just like it has the gravity of the world focused on these kind of six or seven people. They are kind of dealing with the big moral issues of the day, whereas, like, you know, Justice League is just men in tights running around.
Well, essentially, they've got different ambitions, I suppose, in Justice League's defence.
Yeah.
The performances in this, I think, are universally excellent, no?
I was really
impressed with Jason Mitchell, who plays Eazy-E in Straight Outta Compton, and also Jonathan Banks as the horrible father of one of the families.
There are these older figures in these families who, you know, for them, the culture of slavery is, you know, is almost a real memory.
Right.
And for him, Jonathan Banks, this sort of, you know, racist monster. It's an incredible performance, having only really seen him in Community.
He has quite a role in Breaking Bad.
He is in Breaking Bad. I've not watched Breaking Bad all the way through.
But he's sort of representative of the old era. And you got Jason Clarke, who's the father, son, who is kind of trapped between these two ways of thinking.
And then you have almost a little bit younger generation within that generation, which is Garrett Hedlund, who is the younger brother who goes to war and comes back, but then also Kerry Mulligan as Jason Clarke's wife, who is a cosmopolitan. She wants to play piano and stay in the city, but is dragged back into the farm, you know, back into the country.
I know this is from a very popular book, but I did have some... It did make me raise an eyebrow a little bit how the family goes from this kind of comfortable middle-class Memphis life to being... essentially living in the dirt in the middle of a field in Mississippi.
Well, it's a bureaucratic error, isn't it?
I suppose it is.
When we were talking last night about it, one of the things you mentioned that I wanted to bring up was I personally think that the use of voiceover in this film is astonishing.
Oh, really? Okay.
It is based on a novel, and it gives the film a sort of slightly literary dimension, or at least sort of like links it back to the sort of pages of a book. I love this kind of almost sort of Days of Heaven-like way of that it kind of dives into people's heads, and the narrations aren't kind of, they're not sort of narrative-y. No. They're more kind of atmospheric. They're more like, here is my thoughts on this specific moment, rather than like commentating on what's happening and who, what does X feel about Y and how am I going to, it's like these kind of musings on life. And I just thought they were really, really like poetic. And
when we talk about emotional landscape, that's a way that this film completely broadens that landscape. And you have maybe, what was it, 5 or 6 characters that have that internal monologue, but it just expands both into the past, into the future, the ambitions, the feelings, it's all there.
And the reason that I mention this is curious, is because I actually didn't, that was one of the things I didn't like about the film. It did feel very much like that's something that would work in a book, but essentially I found it a distraction in the movie. It felt like a literary shorthand, because they do essentially say, and this is what I was feeling at this point. At kind of random intervals, you get like one or two lines from one character, and then 5 minutes later another character will come in. Interestingly, you only get it from the sympathetic characters. You don't get it from Jason Clarke's character or the Jonathan Banks, the patriarchs, which would have been really interesting, I think, to put the thinking behind what their positions were. My other issue, because I did have a couple with this movie, although broadly speaking I enjoyed it, was the coda, which, after the kind of Steinbeckian miserable sweep of the movie, which I thought was by and large great, the coda, I found the shift of tone that I struggled to attach any kind of weight to. I found its tone a little bit jarring, but yeah, broadly speaking, it's a hell of a ride.
I mean, she's a director, I think I'm like in for whatever she does now.
Okay.
Well, it's well acted. It's really well shot. And is it just going to Netflix, or is it actually having a
proper release? I think it's
coming out
in the cinema. And then going on to Netflix.
Those Netflix guys, hey, they're busy.
They swept in and bought it in Sundance, didn't they?
Boom. Yeah. Have some of that.
I think also Best Picture.
You're starting the campaign right here.
I would say that it would be a good one.
It'd be interesting to have Netflix in the conversation like that.
Well, you have to wonder how many films are actually going to be up for the full consideration with the current climate. Tell you what, though, David, next up, let's have a look at a previous nominee for Best Picture at those Oscars. It is this week's Film Club, Sidney Lumet's 1975 classic, Dog Day Afternoon.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Here's Al Pacino as Sonny in a bank and very much in the media spotlight.
You know how much a bank teller makes a week?
Not much.
Not much. 115 to start, right? Now, you're going to live on that? I got a wife and a couple of kids. How am I going to live on that? What do you make a week?
Well, I'm here to talk to you, Sonny.
I'm talking to you. We're entertainment, right? What do you got for us?
Well, what do you want to get for it? You expect to be paid because of appearing?
No, I don't want to be paid. I don't need to be paid. Look, I'm here with my partner and 9 other people. See, we're dying, man. You know? You're going to see our brains on a sidewalk. They're going to spill our guts out. Now, you're going to show that on television? Have all your housewives look at that instead of As the World Turns? I mean, what do you got for me? I want something for that.
Sonny.
Yeah?
You could give up.
So, real-life story, this, of a small-scale heist that goes wrong and the standoff that develops on one of the hottest days of a New York summer. And what did listeners make of this, David?
Well, Isabella Garcia, says one of my all-time favourite films, Young Pacino, was electric. Andy Black, wonderful film. And then we've got a comment from Ian Wright, a brilliant film. Oddly enough, I first saw it thanks to being intrigued by John Travolta's monologue about it in The Risible Swordfish. At least something good came of having seen that movie. About 2 years ago, I went to a screening of it in Dublin's terrific Lighthouse Cinema and realised for the first time just how funny it was. Perhaps some aspects of the film only became apparent when viewed as part of an audience.
Right. Oh, Michael.
So AJ in Yorkshire says, I can't believe I hadn't watched this movie before. It's quite brilliant. No wonder the screenplay won an Oscar. It has to go in my top five films of all time.
Yeah.
I agree. I hadn't seen this film before. This was one of my rainy day movies. Mm. And it was a really terrific watch. And then Tom Joyce. I'd forgotten just how good this film is. It's funny, chaotic and tragic in equal measure. I love how a stifling, angry New York is embodied in Pacino's Sonny and the direction. Performances and editing all seems to give space for the effortlessly naturalistic script to shine.
Yeah. Naturalistic, what a great word for this film, because everything about it just feels like it's actually happening and Sidney Lumet's just rolling a camera on it. Mm-hmm. Magnificently framed and staged movie. Astrowiz says, I developed a bit of an allergy to Pacino in the 2000s, but wow, he was great in Dog Day Afternoon. Right from the opening 5 minutes, I knew I was in for a treat of a movie. Interesting side conversation. When did young Pacino become old Pacino? Because I remember being shocked when he suddenly turned up, probably around Scent of a Woman era, mm-hmm. having been, you know, the young Michael Corleone to suddenly being the hoo-ha! And Stuart Roche, Dog Day Afternoon, excellent movie, great performances from Pacino and John Cazale. Worth mentioning him again. He died young, but had some excellent performances in great movies, Godfather's Part 1 and 2. And, of course, Deer Hunter, Stuart would like to suggest for film club L.A. Confidential. But that's got Kevin Spacey in it. But John Cazale, let's have a quick word about him and his doom-laden puppy eyes.
He's a kind of strange one in this film. And yeah, he is, you know, he's obviously was with Pacino in the Godfather film.
Well, supposedly, I read this in, you know, online trivia. Well, first of all, Al Pacino was down to do this part, but he was so exhausted from doing the Godfather. He said, I can't work myself into that state again. Mm. So Sidney Lumet went, all right, I'll give it to Dustin Hoffman. At which point, Al Pacino went, you know what? And then he said, basically, you have to have John Cazale in this. Sidney Lumet felt that he wasn't the right age, because I think the partner, Sal, is meant to be 18. But when he met John Cazale, he went, yeah, actually, you're really terrific. He doesn't do much, but boy, does he kind of do a lot in this film.
He does everything without doing anything. Right. He just kind of lurks in the background and he's trigger happy. And, you know, he's very much inside Pacino's head, rather than like being a sort of physical presence. He's
right.
Like, you know, I think he's...
Were this to be a kind of like Fight Club scenario where Sal doesn't actually exist, but it's just an externalisation?
It could be. The kind of, I want to sort of send it all to hell and just blow everyone away and kind of attitude. But someone commented before, you know, it's evident from the off how great Pacino is in this. Mm. And I think it's from like the very first shot of him where... Well, they're waiting in a car outside and they're all kind of in their sort of three-piece suits and he's got the most... non-ominous looking rose box. And you're like, should a security guard let a man with a very long rose box into a bank? But anyway, there's this moment where he's kind of, his eyes sort of twitch, where like someone whispers something to him and his eyes kind of twitch around and you can see him thinking. And you just know from that moment, this is going to be great. Pacino's going to go all in. And seeing an actor just think is just a beautiful thing, I think.
Listeners, if you didn't get the chance to see it for this week, I hope we haven't spoiled anything, but do go away and watch it. A couple of other little facts for you, Michael. You may be aware of this. The real bank robber, John Wojtowicz, actually went to the cinema to watch The Godfather on the very day that he staged the bank robbery to get ideas, apparently. And this I particularly like. The bar across the street from the bank that they're robbing in the movie is clearly seen to be Moe's Tavern. And Hank Azaria, who voices Moe in The Simpsons, has stated that the inspiration for Moe's voice was Sonny.
Oh, wow.
It comes full circle.
Did you know what also is interesting? I think, although it is like a heist movie, it's also a kind of media maelstrom movie as well. I mean, it's about how the police and the media kind of almost build him up into a celebrity. It's interesting that Lumet also made the movie Network, which is currently has Bryan Cranston... As Howard Beale
at the National.
At the National.
Oh, really?
So they made a stage version of Network. So you could do a film club and theatre double bill extravaganza.
Have either of you seen this?
No, my colleague went to see it yesterday and said it was great.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, that sounds absolutely terrific, doesn't it? Yeah, Bryan Cranston, The National, Network. Anything else you'd like to add about this, Michael?
What I find interesting, and again, this might be apocryphal, citation may be needed for this, but I hear that the real bank robber, Sonny in real life, the money that he made from selling his story for the film, was he then funneled that back to his girlfriend for the gender reconfirmation surgery.
Right.
So actually...
Played by Chris Sarandon in the film, Princess Bride.
He's great in this.
He's good.
I unrecognisable, actually. Yeah. I mean, yeah, I knew him also from Fright Night, where he plays the kind
one.
Of crazy, kind of sexy vampire. He's kind of a theatre actor, and this really shows his versatility, and he's not just the kind of Prince Humperdinck and sexy vampire kind of.
I also particularly enjoyed seeing Bishop out of Aliens playing a key role in this.
That's who the cyborg was based on. No, not really.
Excellent. All right, so that was this week's film club. What are we going to follow that up with next week, David?
So next week is going to be discussions on the film Battle of the Sexes with Steve Carell and Emma Stone. And then we've also got Clooney directing a Coen Brothers, half a Coen Brothers script in Suburbicon.
So who wrote the other half?
Clooney.
Okay.
And then we've got Good Night and Good Luck, which is Clooney's 2005 film.
We must not confuse dissent with disloyalty. We must remember always that accusation is not proof, and that conviction depends upon evidence and due process of law. We will not walk in fear one of another. We will not be driven by fear into an age of unreason if we dig deep in our history and our doctrine, and remember that we are not descended from fearful men, not from men who feared to write, to associate, to speak, and to defend the causes that were for the moment unpopular. This is no time for men who oppose Senator McCarthy's methods to keep silent, or for those who approve. We can deny our heritage and our history, but we cannot escape responsibility for the results. We proclaim ourselves, indeed, as we are, the defenders of freedom wherever it continues to exist in the world. But we cannot defend freedom abroad by deserting it at home.
And, yeah, I think it would be a nice exploration into Clooney's directorial side project.
Right. This, I would say, is probably his most successful?
I would say so, yeah.
All right.
I've seen Leatherheads. Has anyone out in the world seen Leatherheads?
If you've seen Leatherheads, listeners, do let David know. Right, well, that's coming up next week. The excellent Battle of the Sexes. I haven't seen Suburbicon yet, but I'm looking forward to that. Michael, what are you going off to see next?
I still haven't seen Paddington 2, which I hear is fantastic.
Oh, lucky chap. Although I don't want to, spoil it with overly inflated expectations.
I've seen Babe Pig in the City as well.
That's on my watch list. Anything else you'd like to flag up before we press stop?
One thing I would like to flag is it's still on iPlayer for a week, is one of the great documentaries of the year, The Work, about group therapy sessions in Folsom Prison in California. Mm. Every year, 5 members of the public are allowed to sit in on these group therapy sessions with real inmates. And it's just a raw, bruising, emotional work of drawing empathy out of these men. It's incredible. It's on iPlayer for a week. It's under Storyville, as opposed to under the film section.
Okay, right. Dave?
I wouldn't mind just flagging our little magazine side project that we do. There's a current new issue of Little White Lies out, inspired by the film Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. And look out for it in newsagents.
When is that
online.
Out?
It's not out until the new year.
Okay.
Early new year. And got a double cover.
Really?
Yeah.
What, you mean the back?
The back what?
Well, the back cover. What's the double bit?
Oh, it's just got 2 different covers, alternative covers.
Oh, you've done that kind of. You've gone down that other film publication route of having collectible covers, have you?
No, they're not collectible. It's just a fun random option. You don't need to buy both.
Okay. I like the ones you can colour in yourself.
Yeah.
Can you do more of those?
No, there's only a 1 ever colouring cover. We can only do that once.
All right then. Well, I hope you have a splendid week watching movies, listeners, wherever it might be. Many thanks to Michael and David for joining us today, and everyone for your comments. We'll see you again next week. This has been a 7 Digital production.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.